From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, helping soldiers face their fear and uncertainty. We talk with retired Army Colonel James Martin. He was the senior social worker during the Gulf War of 91. He helped prepare soldiers for the Gulf, counseled them during the war, and debriefed them when the fighting was over. Also, the war on television, we talk with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton about how Americans are responding to images of the war. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Elephant, the new CD by the White Stripes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. troops continue to expand their control in Baghdad today, fighting on both sides of the Tigris River. Three journalists were killed by U.S. fire. Two journalists died and three others were hurt when a U.S. tank fired a round into the Palestine Hotel, where most foreign journalists are staying, including NPR's Anne Garrels.
It was a tank shell, and it hit on the 15th floor. We've heard the reports that American soldiers thought that there were snipers in this hotel or around this hotel. I can only say I have never heard any outgoing shooting from this hotel. They also noted that there were men with binoculars on the roof. I can only say that there are reporters here with binoculars who've been surveying the distant battle.
NPR's Anne Garrels in Baghdad, who had to evacuate the Palestine Hotel for a time today after the hotel was hit by tank fire. On the other side of the Tigris River, a U.S. bomb killed a Jordanian reporter at the Baghdad office of Al Jazeera, the Arabic language television channel. Central Command said its forces had been fired upon from the Al Jazeera building. U.S. officials say they don't know whether Saddam Hussein was killed in an airstrike yesterday that destroyed a building in a wealthy section of Baghdad. They said the building was attacked because of intelligence that showed Saddam and his sons might be there. President Bush told reporters in Northern Ireland that whether Saddam is alive or not, his control over Iraq is almost gone.
That grip I used to describe that Saddam had around the throats of the Iraqi people are loosening. I can't tell you if all 10 fingers are off the throat. But finger by finger's coming off.
President Bush in Belfast, Northern Ireland. The 1st Marine Division moved into a northeastern suburb of Baghdad today known as Saddam City. The BBC's David Willis says the Marines got a good reception in the Shiite Muslim area, which has been ill-treated by Saddam's government over the years.
On the way here, we came under attack from snipers. Three Marines were injured in that. And after that... The Marines attacked a couple of Iraqi tanks after we crossed the Tigris River in their amphibious assault vehicle. But I have to say that generally the reception has been cordial. There's been little resistance apart from that, just a lot of smiling, waving people, some of whom have come forward to warn the Marines of their whereabouts, of the whereabouts of various militiamen and indeed Republican Guard.
The BBC's David Willis reporting with the 1st Marine Division in Saddam City. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 1 point to close at 8,298 in heavy trading. Declining issues led advances by a small margin. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 6 to close at 1,382. This is NPR News. A new audio tape that purports to come from Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden is urging Muslims to commit suicide attacks against U.S. and British interests to avenge the war in Iraq. The tape was obtained in Pakistan by the Associated Press, which says it hasn't been confirmed that bin Laden is the speaker. It calls on Muslims to avenge the children of Iraq and also to attack governments in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. It accuses those governments of being agents of America. The writer Sabina Murray is this year's winner of the Penn Faulkner Award for Literature. The award is America's largest peer-juried literary competition and carries a $15,000 prize. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Sabina Murray's collection of stories is called The Caprices, and it's about people whose lives are transformed by the arbitrary consequences of war. The book takes place during World War II in the Pacific, when the Japanese occupied the Philippines. Murray's book has been celebrated for its intensity and range. Her characters include American, Indian, and Japanese soldiers, Filipino civilians, and Amelia Earhart. This is Murray's second work of fiction. Her next book, she says, will be about cannibalism. Netta Ulaby, NPR News, Washington.
The Energy Department says the price of gasoline is expected to fall this summer, in part because of Allied progress in the war against Iraq. The agency has reduced its estimate of the average cost of a gallon of gas by 14 cents. The cost of a barrel of crude has fallen by about $12 a barrel since the end of February. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Martin, has helped soldiers deal with the stresses of war. He's a retired colonel who spent 26 years as an Army social worker. During the Vietnam War, he worked at Army medical centers in the U.S. In 1991, he was the senior social work officer in the Gulf War. Shortly after the invasion of Kuwait, during the planning of the war, he was sent to the region to assess stress issues American soldiers would face. He then went to Germany to help prepare American forces for their deployment. During the ground war, he was part of a mental health team for the Army's 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. He later co-edited the book The Gulf War and Mental Health. He currently works as a consultant to the Army, assessing quality of life issues for military families. He's also an associate professor at the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research just outside of Philadelphia. Now, one of the things you did in the Gulf War in the early 90s was to assess what the greatest stresses were going to be for soldiers. I would imagine two of the things at the top of the list were desert warfare, being in the desert a long time, and the possibility of facing chemical or biological weapons attacks. How did that figure into the recommendations that you made in your initial report about what stress the soldiers would be facing?
I would characterize the stresses a little bit differently.
Yeah?
And I would characterize them, I think the model that we use is that there are phases of stress. And interestingly, one of the most important stresses of stress actually occurs at home station before deployment. It's that departure and the nature of that departure. Remembering that when individuals deploy, it's a highly stressful period. People are very busy. There's a lot going on, especially in the context of families and how families are trying to cope. If I'm a service member, I'm trying to work, I'm working very hard in getting myself ready to deploy, but it's also at a time when my spouse and my children are likely to be having a lot of difficulty with their own fear and their own concern. And so I'm trying to cope with all of that at one time. So departure really becomes one of the key stress periods. Then if you think about this in the context of the Gulf War, just the physical stress and the demands associated with deploying into this kind of environment and getting moved out, the heat, just workload, physically it's a very, very taxing experience for most of these folks. Living in very crowded conditions during that initial phase when one is moving into a theater like the theater that they're in now. And then you have all of the uncertainties in front of you. I think that in the first Gulf War, one of the clear uncertainties and difficulties was the fact that there was a long period of time when we weren't sure what was going to happen. We weren't sure how long we were going to be there. And for those soldiers, especially those in support positions who were in the large urban areas, there was the threat of Scud missile attack. And that was an extremely anxiety-provoking period.
What were you able to tell soldiers who were worried about the possibility of chemical or biological weapons being used against them?
I think the real issue is trust and confidence in your equipment and your skills. And then the other factor is one of being part of a collective. I mean, I can tell you from my own personal experience, the first night I arrived in Saudi Arabia before I hooked up with my colleague, I was sleeping at one of the Army's combat hospitals, and I was literally in a tent by myself. And that night, we had four different Scud alerts where I had to put on full chemical gear. And I was there by myself that entire evening. I would have given anything for somebody to talk to. It was it really was a very anxious period, and your mind just, you know, goes off in a thousand different directions, none of which are good. And so that notion of being embedded in a group of people who you can have a shared experience with and who you can provide support and comfort for one another is a critical aspect of this.
Were you in the position as a social worker of having to tell the difference between normal battle stress and extreme battle stress and one to take a soldier out of combat?
Yeah, I'll give you a case example. One of the things that occurred just before the start of the ground invasion, we were with, at that point, the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, and we had a senior enlisted soldier brought to us by his chaplain. And the chaplain was looking for our assistance in getting this sergeant evacuated out of the theater. And what had happened is that he had had the opportunity to contact home, and he had found it, and home in this case was Germany. We were with a unit from Germany. And he had learned that his wife had been raped or assaulted and was actually in the hospital, and that his two children were being cared for by a neighbor. And you could imagine the emotional state that this sergeant was in. We spent basically an evening with him in our tent, and it became very clear to us that he was clearly reacting to the emotional trauma of what he had just learned and his own sense of helplessness and guilt about his family. But it was also clear that taking him from the theater at that point probably would have done more harm than good. And when I say that, what I mean is that this is an individual who at that point was probably responsible for 15 or 20 young soldiers in his unit, and they were about to go into combat within a day or so. If anything had happened to those soldiers in combat in his absence, it's probably something he never would have been able to forgive himself for, you know, feeling blame and guilt. In this case, the reality was that his wife was in an Army hospital. He knew she was being taken care of. She was okay. She had experienced a very traumatic event. And he knew his kids were okay. He knew the family that his kids were with. And so what we did was basically try to give him an opportunity to ventilate his concerns, to emotionally get himself back together again, and to help make a decision that his job was one of staying with his soldiers, getting them through this initial combat, and then we promised to work with him to get him home as quickly as we could after that, and to try to maintain information about his family. But it presented the unique situation that these people are in. I'm sure that even today in the Gulf War, there are soldiers that are learning that parents have died, that family members have been in accidents. And you have to balance those kinds of things with the reality of the responsibilities that these people have in the context of these combat operations. Very difficult.
Can that kind of worry about the people who you've left at home, particularly if those people are in jeopardy, can that kind of worry be dangerously distracting if you're in combat?
It could be, and I think that's part of what we had to decide on, whether we could help this individual pull himself together in a way that he could be an effective soldier. And our belief after having spent a day with him is that he was able to do that. But you're right, that becomes the issue. And you think about that in all kinds of stress, whether it's the stress of something occurring on the home front. Remember that this age of instant communication, that those kinds of things are now happening all the time. And it's something that we have to learn how to deal with and deal with effectively.
So were you able to get the soldier home fairly quickly?
Yeah, after the ground war phase was over, he was one of the first to depart back to his unit in Germany. And subsequent to the invasion and the initial phase of the ground war, I know that he had communication with his spouse.
Now, during the Gulf War in 91, did you deal with any soldiers who were truly overcome by fear and who were having enormous difficulty functioning?
In terms of my own experience, I don't think that we saw any soldiers in that context. Where we did see them was subsequent to the movement into Kuwait and Iraq. Soldiers who had been overwhelmed by certain events, and two that come to my mind that are relevant for today is the issues of friendly fire and casualties in units when friendly fire occurs, and in another case, accidental death, which is common and can be emotionally just as upsetting.
So you dealt with people in units where some people had been killed by friendly fire?
Yeah. For example, shortly after the initial phase of the ground war, the unit that we were in, one of the elements of the unit experienced a friendly fire incident where a number of soldiers were killed in sort of the fog of a nighttime operation. And we spent a day with elements of that unit doing some debriefing of soldiers that had been part of that friendly fire episode.
What were they going through? What were some of what was the fear or the anger that they were expressing?
Initially, quite the opposite. I think that when we first arrived at the unit, I would characterize it as just this shroud of depression that had sort of overcome everyone. That, you know, no one was really talking to one another about sort of the events. Everyone, you know, just had this terribly sad look about them. In some sense, I think they were still caught in the shock of the moment. And really, among the things that we did in our small group meetings with these unit members was help them reestablish communication with one another, being able to talk about the event, being able to clarify misperceptions, being able to get a sense of what really happened, being able to get past the issue of, you know, who was to blame, because at that level that really wasn't the sort of the critical issue, and be able to support one another, be able to begin, the kind of bonding that is so important. I mean, I remember very vividly as we were leaving the unit, and this was in the middle of the desert, a senior enlisted member of the unit came up to us and literally gave us both hugs with tears in his eyes that, you know, we had brought some relief. These people had been sitting in the desert at this point for a couple of days. Again, this was after the initial phase of the ground war, and they were simply, I think, shocked in the context of that event.
One of the most important things that soldiers have is the ability to support each other, you know, that solidarity within a troop. So that must be totally undermined when there's accidental friendly fire within the unit.
Clearly, think about it in terms of any major trauma. One of the things that often happens is it's hard for people to talk to one another until they get past that sort of initial phase. You're not sure what to say. It's just a very difficult period. And so, the value or the important factor here is that this was clearly a group that had strong interpersonal relationships. I would contrast that with some other events that we were involved in where the group didn't have that kind of background, where, in fact, the soldiers involved were individuals who were not well known to the group. The example here was a case of a soldier who was killed by stepping on some munitions and two young enlisted medical personnel provided immediate resuscitative first aid, and clearly this young soldier was beyond being saved because of the severe nature of the injuries. But for the rest of the unit, one of the difficulties is that these two medics were not people they really knew. I mean, they had joined the unit a couple of weeks beforehand as fill-in for the unit. And they were both young medics right out of their training, so they were young privates. And the important aspect of that intervention was really our ability to get the unit to, in a sense, open up and wrap its emotional arms around these two young soldiers to help them recognize what a valiant effort they made trying to save the soldier's life, versus, you know, getting rid of any speculation that, you know, the soldier died because the medics were incompetent or, you know, something of that nature. So having those solid bonds beforehand are very, very important attributes.
My guest is retired Army social worker James Martin. He was the senior social worker in the Gulf War of 91. He's currently an associate professor at Bryn Mawr College's Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Martin. He's a retired colonel, Army social worker. He was a senior social work officer in the Gulf War of 91. He's also an associate professor at the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. You were involved with the debriefing of soldiers after the war, when they left the theater of combat. What kind of discussions did you have with the soldiers? And what kind of discussions did you walk away thinking were actually really beneficial?
One of the things that's important to remember, I had talked about the phases of sort of stress, the pre-deployment, the actual experience in the theater of operations. The other stressful period is that period waiting to come home and coming home. One of the things that we have learned historically is that it really is important not to rush that. And by that I mean giving people an opportunity when all of this is over to process what they've experienced with their colleagues, with their buddies, with those that they've shared this experience with. That's why coming home in a sort of a gradual basis is better than a rapid reunion. And we do this now intentionally in many of these kinds of events, whether they deal with hostages or whether they have to do with large-scale military operations.
Why is that helpful?
It gives people a chance to put some context around what they've experienced and to do it with others who have shared those experiences. And it provides a sort of a buffer from the, you know, rapid transition back into other roles. I'm jumping around here a little bit, but maybe this would be helpful. One of the groups that I often wonder about and worry about, and this is not an area where I have expertise, but it will highlight what I mean. If you think about pilots who this morning are getting up and feeding their kids breakfast at home in England, and tonight they're getting on an airplane and flying over Iraq and dropping bombs, and tomorrow morning they're back home trying to deal with domestic sorts of issues. Making that kind of emotional and cognitive shift is very, very demanding. And that's sort of what I mean by this experience. So if I think about the first Gulf War, one of the things that impressed me the most from a leadership perspective was a battalion commander in Germany who, when the unit arrived back in Germany, what he did is, rather than giving everyone immediate leave to let them go home, basically had them work half days. And what it meant was, you had a half a day in the unit sort of protected from all the demands of family and a half a day to just sort of chill out with your peers. And it was a transition time. It really made a difference. People really were able to walk that bridge from being a combat soldier into being a father or a husband. And so it sort of avoided all of the negative things associated with too rapid a transition.
I imagine a lot of people return from war feeling that they're not the same person they were when they left home for war, and that they're assumed to be the same person, and they have to fit in to that same identity that they no longer have. Have you found that is an issue for a lot of soldiers returning home?
I think that for any of us, those monumental experiences in life have that kind of effect, and it's not that we're not the same person. It's just that, you know, we've added experiences, and we may see things a little bit differently. I know from my own experience, if you ask me the things that I found most traumatic, it really had to do with the suffering that I saw in the Iraqis that were killed and wounded, in the civilian population especially, the refugees. And it's important to remember that, you know, while we see the stress that our combat forces experience who are directly engaged, those military members who are in roles that have to do with humanitarian care, whether it's taking care of prisoners of war, or providing medical treatment, or handling the remains of human bodies, that this is a very demanding experience and is something that becomes part of who and what these people are in the future, hopefully in a positive way.
James Martin was senior Army social worker in the Gulf War of 91 and is an associate professor at the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by A&D, presenting the premiere of Napoleon, an original movie starring Isabella Rossellini and John Malkovich, tonight at 8 p.m., 7 Central on A&D. And from Harcourt, publisher of When I Was a Young Man, former Senator Bob Kerrey's memoir about his experience as a Navy SEAL during the Vietnam War. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the emotional issues soldiers are likely to face after the war when they return home. We continue our conversation with retired Army social worker James Martin. And we talk with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton about how Americans are responding to watching the war on TV. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the White Stripes.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Martin, a retired colonel who was the senior social work officer in the Gulf War of 91. He co-edited the book The Gulf War and Mental Health. During the Vietnam War, he worked at Army medical centers in the U.S. Martin still consults with the Army, assessing quality of life issues for military families. And he's an associate professor at the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. The Vietnam War was still fresh in everyone's mind during the Gulf War of 91. And I know one of the things that you and a lot of other mental health workers during the war tried to do is to prevent the kind of post-traumatic shock syndrome that so many veterans of the Vietnam War had experienced. What did you try to do in the Gulf War after battle to prevent post-traumatic stress syndrome?
I'd like to answer that a little bit differently.
Sure.
And I would do that in the context of, I think, the effort that's been made to develop the current force that we have, the all-volunteer force. Clearly, in my mind, the significant difference between the Vietnam era and today is really that force. I mean, we have a force of volunteers. These are very well-trained, very well-led, very well-equipped soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen. And it's that context in terms of preventative factors that I think address a number of the Vietnam era issues that are associated with PTSD and other kinds of things. Now, that's not to say that you don't have these kinds of conditions occur. I was going to use the word stress-related, and that's probably the best way to characterize that. Because war is horrific. This is not something that's fun. This is not something that's easy. This is not something that's pleasant. One of the terms that I coined in my own experience in the Gulf was the notion of what I call pockets of trauma. And I think that's true today in terms of the current operations in Iraq. We have in an overall very monumentous victory, we have pockets of trauma, people whose lives have been altered forever by the events that they've experienced.
Are you saying that you think in the volunteer army, in a more professionalized army, that soldiers are less likely to have post-traumatic stress syndrome because this is something they volunteered for and that they've been very well prepared for?
These are all factors that I think contribute in a preventative way. And it's especially, I think, relevant in the context of the selection factors. You know, we're selecting highly motivated, healthy individuals. You have to remember that about a third of our personnel do not complete a first enlistment. These individuals, often for behavioral-related issues, do not remain in the military. So the people that you have in your combat force are people who have passed a couple of hurdles. You know, they're high school graduates, they don't have a felony, they've been able to get through rigorous basic training, and they've been through this, you know, first enculturation period. They're well-trained. I think they're extremely well-led. We've seen from what we have on the news the quality of the equipment that our forces have. And so it's a sense of strength and confidence and resiliency that I think provide buffers against the enormous stress that people experience in combat. That doesn't mean that there are not going to be events that are overwhelming.
From what you've seen so far of this war in Iraq, do you think there are any unique problems that the soldiers will face when they return home?
The one that I guess I worry about the most is the issue of what appears to be, and again, I only know what I see on the news, but appears to be the large numbers of Iraqi casualties who are being killed in direct engagement with our military forces. And the notion that there are some number of these individuals who are out there only because if they don't, they'll be killed by, the Iraqi death squads. And so if I try to picture myself as a soldier, what that means to engage a combatant who doesn't want to be there, who's there with a gun to their back, and to think about what that has meant in terms of my killing them, those may be issues that people have to struggle with. The other one that's always present is the exposure and experience with refugees, with women, with young children, and to see their tragic injuries and death. Those are images that stay with people. And so I have concern that people are going to need to spend some time trying to deal with some of those issues.
I know your son is a Marine. Is he in the war?
No, my son just finished a tour of duty at Parris Island as a Marine Corps drill instructor and is now in Virginia at a Marines educational program. He and I talked the other night. One of the things that I know I've been concerned about is that as he sees these images on the news, many of these are young Marines who he trained at Parris Island, and I'm sure that that's something that in some ways is difficult for him to look at and think about. And I've told him to, take great honor and strength from the fact that I know he was a good drill instructor, and I know that his Marines were well trained.
James Martin, thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
James Martin was the senior Army social worker in the Gulf War of 91 and is an associate professor at the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. Coming up, we talk with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton about how Americans are being affected by watching the war on TV. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Robert J. Lifton is a psychiatrist who has written extensively about the extremes of war. He's written books about Hiroshima survivors, Nazi doctors, the unique anxieties of the nuclear age, and apocalyptic global terrorism. He's currently a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. We've been checking in with him every few months since the attacks of September 11th. We called him this morning to talk about the impact of watching the war on TV. Dr. Lifton, what are some of your thoughts on how Americans have been affected by watching the war on television?
I think that Americans have been very confused by watching the war, and they've had a lot of conflicting emotions. Maybe the strongest, consistent emotion is a kind of fascination. Yet most people I talk to are torn between that fascination, watching the war, and a certain kind of revulsion or horror and a wish to turn away. A number of people make pledges not to watch the television, or at least not to watch it very much, but they find themselves returning to it. So I think Americans are torn and conflicted by what they're seeing.
I was taking a cab ride the other day, and the driver was talking about it, kind of like, kill the Iraqi kind of thing. Like he seemed to be taking a certain amount of pleasure in the Iraqi deaths, and I don't think he got the point that the purpose of this war is supposed to be not only to find the weapons of mass destruction, but to liberate the Iraqi people. The military is trying really hard to not have Iraqi civilians, but I think some people are just so used to, like, you bomb the country, that's the enemy, and when they kill people, that's good. Do you think that there's some kind of almost confusion among Americans about how to react to civilian deaths? Because, I mean, the country, per se, is not our enemy. It's the regime.
That's right. In a way, war obliterates distinctions, and that's what we're experiencing. So that even though our American leadership makes a distinction between Iraqi leadership, Saddam Hussein, and those who have been around him, and the rest of the Iraqi people, many Americans watching the television can see all Iraqis as the enemy. This also is involved with our so-called war on terrorism. We identify terrorists, but we also identify terrorist nations, as we have identified Iraq, and that becomes confused in American minds. And for those reasons, the Iraqis are labeled as enemies, one and all, and we're to take delight in killing our enemies. That, of course, is a very unhealthy kind of emotion stimulated in Americans that this war brings out.
Are you concerned about how Americans handle victory in Iraq?
I'm deeply concerned about how we handle victory in Iraq. The triumphalism that has been displayed on the media by journalists, especially television journalists, is really disturbing because they behave as though this is a glorious moment in American history and especially American military history, as opposed to what I take to be the truth. This is an example of the world's most powerful military machine overwhelming a rather small and rather weak country. It is not a moment of glorious victory. It is a moment for many of us of shame. But in any case, the impulse toward triumphalism is there every day, almost every minute on the television, and I think it's profoundly harmful to us ethically and psychologically.
How?
It's harmful to us because it makes us callous. It reinforces our most aggressive impulses, and it asserts that we are in the right in killing so many people, and that there is something glorious and fine and noble in this war. And it gradually has the danger of transforming us into a callous, aggressive people and taking us away from what America has always stood for. And that has to do with genuine democracy and fairness and concern and compassion. This is the very opposite. And to rally round military victory at the expense of all these human lives is against everything that's fine in our tradition.
Nevertheless, when you see scenes of, you know, that warehouse where they found, like, body parts stacked up?
Yes.
When you see scenes like that, do you think, well, you know, even though you oppose the war, do you think maybe this war wasn't such a bad idea? Look at the kind of torture and mutilation that was going on under the Saddam Hussein regime.
In a way, the administration claim and its policy has benefited from Saddam Hussein's character. He has been an evil dictator. There's no doubt about it. He has killed many people. He has been murderous. He has stood for egregious policies of killing and torture. To that extent, some Americans can take solace as they see Iraqi people freed from this kind of domination and this kind of threat that they constantly live under. But whether that can justify in their minds, in our minds, this overall war making is another matter.
Although you oppose the war, have you been impressed with the military's restraint in terms of its precision targeting with the bombing, in terms of trying, you know, very hard to minimize the casualties of civilians?
I think that the military has tried to minimize the casualties among civilians. But on the other hand, when it has had an objective that it considers a military objective, it has not hesitated to use very, very heavy bombing, which has to kill a lot of civilians. So although I'm aware of that restraint, I have to say that I'm more impressed with the very large numbers of people who are being killed. I don't know the numbers, but they have to be in the tens of thousands when one includes the Iraqi military, who are mostly conscripts and not terrorists on the one hand, and above all, Iraqi civilians. So yes, there has been an attempt to limit the deaths of civilians, but many, many civilians have been killed.
After the fighting stops, the next step is that an interim authority is created in Iraq, and until Iraq, you know, can really stand on its own as a democracy, the United States is going to have some responsibility for that country. What have you been thinking about regarding how that responsibility is going to change us as a country, or, you know, just affect us, affect the national consciousness of the country?
Here I fear that the American need to control that process, as opposed to internationalizing it, will be really harmful and self-defeating. Because if we don't internationalize it, if we don't bring in the UN to play the major part in this process of transition and the long-term rehabilitation of Iraq, then the government will have no legitimacy and our motives in Iraq will have no legitimacy. But beyond that political policy, I worry about us as a people in the future. I worry a great deal because we run the danger of becoming increasingly numbed with diminished inclination to feel the pain of others as we inflict our military on the world and set up a new government in Iraq. Will that turn us into a callous people? Are we changing in terms of our traditions of genuine compassion and true democracy? Are we becoming bullies in the world, and are we as ordinary Americans joining in that process? And in a way, are we not responsible for it? So I worry about our psyches and about our souls.
But that gets to the fundamental difference about how this war is viewed. You're worried about us becoming bullies, but the people who support the war are feeling very good right now and see themselves as liberators of people who have been very oppressed. I mean, that's like the fundamental difference here. Are we bullies or are we benevolent liberators?
Yes, you can look at the events on the screen or in your newspapers and have two very different narratives in your understanding of them. One is, as you said, the narrative of those who are making the war, that we are liberators, we are bringing democracy to Iraq and to the Middle East in general. The other narrative, which I think is the more accurate one, is that we are bullies. We have a plan that's been in place for at least 10 years or longer to dominate the Middle East and to take over Iraq, an impulse which developed right after the first Gulf War and which was expressed immediately after 9/11, and that this is a model of approaches to other countries, either because they seem to be opposed to our interests or because there's some danger of their acquiring weapons of mass destruction. I think the evidence really suggests this second narrative, and that's the way people who oppose the war see these events on television, and it's one reason why they're so painful for us to watch. We don't see the process as leading to a compassionate outcome. We see it as part of a bullying policy all through the world that's dangerous to the world and dangerous to us as Americans.
Do you think that these two narratives will continue to define America for a while, the bully versus the liberator narrative?
I think these two narratives will continue to define America. I think it's going to be hard to sustain a pure liberator model just because of everything that's going to transpire about who controls what in post-war Iraq. Moreover, post-war Iraq may not be entirely post-war. There could be guerrilla warfare or suicide attacks and certainly extreme unrest all through the Arab world. But certainly the narrative of the bully, and it's more than just a bully, it's a whole psychological projection of not only military domination of the world, but of control of events, of control of history. And we can have that projection because we do have such an extraordinary amount of military power. What I think is forgotten in this, and it's part of this second narrative, is that any effort to control history, any effort to be dominant in the world, has to fail. And the failure could bring enormous pain, not just to the rest of the world, but to us as well.
Dr. Lifton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton is a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His latest book is called Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence, and the New Global Terrorism. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the White Stripes. This is Fresh Air. The White Stripes have a new CD called Elephant. Their previous CD, White Blood Cells, was hailed for the stripped-down, aggressive approach of its duo, drummer Meg White and guitarist Jack White. Ken Tucker says the new CD is an even more adventurous piece of work.
That all this constant interaction is just the kind to make you drive yourself away. Each simple gesture done by me is counteracted and leaves me standing here with nothing else to say. Completely baffled by a backward indication that an inspired word will come across your tongue. Hands moving up but to propel the situation have simply halted, now the conversation's done.
The White Stripes' music frequently seems to be one long, varied meditation about being abandoned, feeling alone, and acknowledging the intersection of panic and freedom that such a situation can inspire inside you. Jack White talks to himself on that song, There's No Home For You Here, turning inner conversations into public explosions of frustration, temper, and remorse.
I saw you standing in the corner on the edge of a I saw you standing in the corner. Come to me again in the cold, cold night. In the cold, cold night.
That's Meg White picking up Jack's idea of chilly isolation. Fear, loneliness, and yet also an eerie calmness. The comfort anyone can derive from a solitude spent remembering the pleasures of old passions and the promise of new beginnings.
We started living in an old house. My mom gave birth and we were checking it out. It was a baby boy, so we bought him a toy. It was a Recon, and it was 1981. We named him Baby. He had a toothache. He started crying. It sounded like an earthquake. Now we're a family, and we're all right now.
There, the White Stripes are using simple distorted guitar chords and elementary drum slams to make a nightmare dream stark and hypnotic. Sometimes Jack and Meg White strike me as the music version of David Lynch's latter-day movies, in love with earnestness and perversity in equal measures, and making no distinction between them, or rather, doing their best to blur those distinctions, because it's in the blurring that art is created. And sometimes they just want to rock out. Doing publicity for their last album, Jack and Meg White played coy about whether they were married, divorced, or brother and sister. The gimmick got old, and I'm glad it no longer seems to be of much interest to them or to their audience. That's good, because the White Stripes have a lot more on their minds than media-teasing role-playing. They have their own little musical universe to create for themselves, and from the sound of this album, Elephant, there may or may not be room in it for you.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Our rock critic Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Elephant by the White Stripes.
Well, it's true that we love one another.
I love Jack White like a little brother.
Well, Holly, I love you too. But there's just so much that I don't know about you.
Jack, give me some money to pay my bill.
All the dough I give you, Holly, you've been using on pain pills.
Jack, will you call me if you're able?
I got your phone number written in the back of my Bible.
Jack, I think you're pulling my leg. And I think maybe I better ask Meg. Meg, do you think Jack really loves me?
You know I don't care, cause Jack really bugs me. Why don't you ask him now?
Well, I would, but Meg, I really just don't know how.
Just say, Jack, do you adore me?
Well, I would, Holly, but love really bores me.
Then I guess we should just be friends.
I'm just kidding, Holly, you know that I'll love you till the end.
Well, it's true that we love one another. I love Jack White like a little brother.
Well, Holly, I love you too, but there's just so much that I don't know about you.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Scorched Earth, a novel of suspense by David L. Robbins, author of War of the Rats. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the challenges America will face in reconstructing Iraq and trying to create a democracy. We talk with Bathsheba Crocker, co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.